Welcome to Perfectly Unfiltered, the podcast where I have perfectly unfiltered conversations with real people sharing real stories about redefining roles at home and in the workplace. I will also be talking with changemakers, learning what they are doing to open the doors for women and the realities of creating a diverse and inclusive workforce. Together, we can build a community where we all win. I'm your host, Noor Haisham Fawaz, and this is Perfectly Unfiltered.
Welcome back to Perfectly Unfiltered. Today's guest, Ali Moser, is an absolute fountain of knowledge in this podcast episode where she discusses with Noor her career path and the work she does at TD in the D&I workspace. Seriously, I could listen to her talk all day. Her passions for finance and activism have always been kind of parallel to each other. So she says she is a banker by day. You know, she's a finance gal through and through. However, her activism was always a passion on her own time. But she kind of came to a point where she wondered how could she create change and have conversations with people to bring her two passions together. And I think that's very important in the workspace. So for the past year, she's been doing just that. Ali has explained that she has uncomfortable conversations with senior leaders. So they have to sit in a level of vulnerability, as she says, so they can hear it in a safe way and then digest it. And then Ali's job is to support them in implementing that change into the business. Join Noor and Ali as they discuss TD's impact in the diversity and inclusion spaces, how they're moving the needle, and what is needed to move further and ensure that we're making the needed changes. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Perfectly Unfiltered podcast, Ali.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so thrilled to have you. I'm sure you know this, but TD Bank is a huge partner of Build a Dream and has really supported our mission to drive diversity and inclusion, not only in the workforce, but by inspiring young women to see themselves in careers in the skilled trades, science, technology, engineering, math, emergency response, and entrepreneurship. So we're so glad to be able to talk to someone that not only works at TD, but is really involved in diversity and inclusion. So on that note, So on that note, can you tell me a little bit about your role at TD and then what brought you into the diversity and inclusion work?
Yeah. So my role at TD is a little ambiguous. So I act as a business consultant and I advise all of our senior leaders and really disseminate the strategy from an enterprise perspective into our broad Canadian personal banking footprint. So when we start to think about that, there's a lot of bank lingo there, but essentially all of our customer-facing businesses, in the simplest form, I would support that as well as our HR partners. And my job fundamentally is to challenge the unconventional, to challenge and bring the most uncomfortable conversation to all of our senior leaders so that they sit in a level of vulnerability so that they can hear it in a safe way, digest it. And then my job is to support them in disseminating that change into the business. Because really, when we think about change, it's the top down. So really leaning into our leadership teams and all of their respective teams to mobilize the business to think inclusion and what does it mean and how do you bring it to life? So being able to deliver that type of strategy across such a broad footprint is the kind of crux of my job. And then to answer your second question, I didn't grow up in this space. So I've always been an activist outside as far as my personal commitments. So heavily involved in my community, and I've always run those in parallel. So I'd have a full, robust career in finance, true and true banker through and through. But did the activism off the side of my desk and really on my personal passions and pursuit. And then it kind of got to this unique point where I was like, is there a way, recognizing my passion, my commitment, and my business strategy acumen that I've had from my finance world, is there a way that I can influence change at a broader scale and influence people 3, 4, 5 times my pay grade to invoke a level of change? And selfishly build a critical experience in myself to be a part of conversations that maybe it would take 5, 6, 7 years to be at that senior executive leadership table. So it really was a reciprocity in that model and that I was looking for a critical experience in my career to stand tall. And how do I do that while still being authentic to my moral compass and values and add a flair of banking into it? So it was really an avant-garde kind of unconventional jump in my career over the last year, I would say. But so far, so good. I mean, the relationships and the conversations are just inspiring, right? So it's a neat space to be in.
There's so many things I want to talk about.
I gave you a lot there.
I'm really impressed. And I love everything that you said. You have no idea. I talked to so many young women about their career journey and their career path, those that have even graduated from post-secondary. And the fact that you were able to bring together your business acumen, like your kind of career goals with your personal, like activist, being an activist, fighting for equality or advocating for equality, bringing that together, I think is really admirable, to be quite honest, and to do it in the business world and in the banking world. I noticed that your title, and I probably should share that. I know it was shared in your bio in the intro, but you're the Senior Manager for Inclusion and Diversity for Canadian Personal Banking, which is interesting because the way you describe your role, you wouldn't assume that from just the title, correct? So, I mean, at least from me, just like reading that. So when you said what you said, I'm like, okay, there's a lot of layers there. So am I understanding you correctly? Like, did you apply for this position or did you essentially create this position and approach the leadership team at TD?
No. So TD, honestly, like, and I'm not saying this, you know, I'm being paid hourly, but I'm not being paid to say this. TD really does have a very strong footprint in the D&I space, and we have a really robust structure. So this was an existing role. We have an entire D&I team that sits within the HR function, and we really have structures within each business line, again, across our global footprint, that has a D&I committee. So a lot of them, they call them like Inclusion and Diversity Leadership Council. So each business would have these respective bodies with all of their respective leaders of that business, owning different area of focuses, owning the different conversations. So this isn't something that we just came up with, you know, because of 2020 and the resurgence of Black Lives Matter and the community impact. There was tons of learning there, but we were already in these spaces. What those experiences showed us is where do we need to lean in more? Where are we, again, in our vulnerability, which is really neat. Where are we getting it wrong in that, you know, we think that we're structured and that we have this amazing, we're ahead of the game, we're, you know, leading the space from a D&I perspective and melding that into finance. But where's the vulnerability here? Because there's still work to do. And that's really what we leveraged 2020 and 2021 so far as we end out our fiscal year to make space. But no, this is an existing footprint. Everyone coming into the role will make it their own. So for me, business acumen, my ability to drive strategy was important for me in coming to this space. So I may articulate this role completely different than if you get one of my peers here on the line. It also just depends on the nuance of the business, right? And what the business need is. My business, fortunately, is the customer facing. So everyone that you interact with from your branch experience, like all these pieces that would aggregate up into me at the top of the house and the leaders that I get to influence and the strategies that I get to support as we bring it back all the way down to our customer in that funnel.
Absolutely incredible. And I'm definitely not surprised that this has been like TD has been leading in this space, because from an organization that focuses on diversity and inclusion in the workforce, TD has been a significant supporter, both financially and just from a leadership lens. Mm-hmm. And we've been very grateful for that. And we've worked with different pockets and different, actually some of those diversity and inclusion committees that you mentioned, we work with different ones across Canada. So that being said, I think I love that you said we have to be vulnerable and really, I think first it comes acceptance and acknowledgement to say, okay, we're doing something wrong because we're not moving the needle. It's not moving as quickly as it should. And there's still a lot of challenges, and having those uncomfortable conversations and being able to present it to the leadership team in a way where it creates an open space for honest dialogue to really help support the strategies that you are advising need to happen in order for us to really and genuinely and intentionally adopt a more diverse and inclusive environment, both at TD and the message that you send to communities globally. What were some of the initial things that you found through this journey of being vulnerable and having these uncomfortable conversations? What were some things that you're like, were so apparent, but unless you really dug deep and analyzed, you wouldn't have noticed it? Because it's the unconscious, I believe it's the unconscious biases and systems that we have in place that are actually limiting the participation and the experience.
That's exactly it. And that would be probably what I would say is the biggest opportunity, I think, as many corporate sectors, especially in Canada. Because when we think about when we start to really dig into DEI and that space of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and we start to look at the parallels within our corporate structures, none of us are free from the real reality check of, are there systemic barriers in all of our process? No matter how amazing you are, no matter how long you've been in that space, There are systems and structures and thoughts and ideals that are ingrained in each of us. So it's really sitting in that. And now as the industry starts to evolve in the DEI space, there's language behind it to describe it. There's language around understanding and unconscious bias as like common stakes, as far as, you know, interchangeable with the word strategy, unconscious bias is out there. And everyone's like, what is this? Let me understand more. I notionally understand what an unconscious bias is. But now when you actually say it in the work context and you actually layer that in as far as what does a leadership mean and a leadership profile mean, and, you know, unconscious bias isn't something that's happening out of the US and it's separate from me. It's something here in Canada, in my place of employment, where I work, it creates an aha moment. And you really start to get a lot of clarity from your leadership team to go, wait a second, there's different paths here. There's different understandings in the spectrum of even processing DEI, because the reality is like, although we do great jobs in developing leadership profiles, we don't like to sit, humans and society doesn't like to sit in a place of discomfort. When we either got it wrong, we offend someone, no one wants to sit in that. So what this is really allowed for is that level of discomfort to say, I'm going to sit in vulnerability and it's not punitive. I'm going to sit and acknowledge my unconscious bias, and it's not punitive. There's a growth within that. There's a humanity and grace within that. So I've seen all of our leaders evolve. And again, everyone's at a different space. And it's the beauty of that, because it shows the growth in humanity and what we're saying as an organization, and what I encourage every organization, no matter big or small, create a space where it isn't punitive, that by being vulnerable, especially within our senior leaders, by saying, you know what, I actually don't understand this community or this language, or my team isn't resonating. Is there some diversity of thought that I could be missing? And asking for that help and not being perceived as I should know this because I'm a senior leader, creating that level of grace really has opened up the doors for conversations. And that's what I see evolving in our space, is that we have the systems, we had the structures, we had the committees, we had the conversations happening, but it wasn't individual. It was broader. This is a macro society issue. It's not, you know, what are we doing internally and what's my individual stake? And really showing the spectrum of, this isn't a white colleagues, white privilege thing. This is an all colleagues, all people, everyone has unconscious bias. You can be Black and have unconscious bias. This isn't one area of focus or one community that's being impacted. It's all of us. So being able to sit in that space and do it with a scale of 90,000 people at the same time, because that's how big our organization is, and get everyone sitting in that level of discomfort, it's so empowering and beautiful. And I think that's the piece where everyone's really let go and took a deep breath to say, hey, by acknowledging this and saying vocally and creating spaces where I can talk about it, I realize I'm not alone, and that, you know, it's not a shame thing. It's, I just need to seek to understand. And then the bank will create resources and connect you to the different methods to understand and process it at your pace, instead of painting D&I with a broad stroke. We're really leaning into the individual experiences. So it's vast. It's a wild space, and DEI continues to evolve, right?
I love the way you just described it. And you mentioned seek to understand and come from a place of grace and not shame or punitive. And that is something that internally at Build a Dream, we talk about often, especially in the recent climate, right? Like the environmental factors with the resurfacing of Black Lives Matter. I mean, that was there, and those that were, you know, always advocating for change in that space, that never went away. It just, luckily, people started paying attention and felt a certain responsibility. And that's, we needed to get to that point where people realize, okay, this is not just happening in the US. This is an issue within our system. And I am responsible, even though I may not be directly contributing to that. I work within the system that is responsible for the barriers that are preventing certain populations from really achieving true equity, as we say, or being or evolving in the spaces that they strive to be heard and seen, and at the tables that we really need that diversity in thought. So I love that you said, seek to understand. And I'm so curious, how did you say 90,000, you're right, like to have people all on the same page in different stages of their journey. What steps did you take? Because like, we're in the business of changing mindsets. That's what I say. I say, I go out every day and I'm selling the idea of a world where we all win. And that means that my gender, my race, my culture, my religion is not going to impact my social status, my economic security, and my job prospects or my growth, because that's truly when you've created a world where we all win, that regardless of our differences, the opportunities mm-hmm. are there.
Yeah, no, I'm in that. I'm in there right there with you, girl. I get it. And it's like, that's what I'm selling. That's my product. I'm selling that dream. No pun intended with build a dream, but you know, that's the exact experience that we're trying to get people to and create a piece of equity. And what does that mean? And how do you do that in a space, again, whether it's a large scale with 90,000 plus people in a global footprint, or whether it's a small mom and pop shop, like it's around, how do you sit in your uncomfortable or your, you know, your sense of vulnerable? What does that look like for you? What are your circles of influence around you so that you can adamantly process those thoughts in a safe space? So recognizing that spectrum of learning. And then how do you, again, create systems so that this isn't just triggered by the media? This isn't because, you know, something happened here in Canada and then we all need to shift our focus and respond. How do we actually just think as good humans all the time with the most equitable mindset and challenge ourselves? Because here's the reality. You maybe, you know, just like everything else, you could be good at something one day, you can go to yoga one day, and you know what, the next day your balance is off. And there's a grace in that. So if we can give ourselves grace for the fact that our yoga practice is individual and that, you know, today may not be my best, but I'm only competing against myself. How do we do that? And that's a big extreme, but it's like when I'm in an environment and I feel uncomfortable or I feel like I'm responding in a different way, how do I build up the tools? And that's what we're trying to do with our colleague base. How do I build up the tools? And it's individual to say, am I responding this way for a reason? Like similar to that, you know, the iceberg, what's happening for me below the surface? Is this the bias? Is there something in the spectrum of my life that may be shading or making me think or react a certain way? Is it a language? So when I hear different languages outside or maybe that I'm not exposed to, do I actively disengage because I just don't understand and I deprioritize that person's accent or language or, you know, the way that they communicate over my own because that's just not my experience? When I feel that, if I've acknowledged that, then I need to lean in those environments. So it's like creating those types of self-reflective tools before you get out into the workforce, before you start interacting with your colleagues, to build it internally, to know what are my five things that I'm going to be super in tune with this week and continue to hold yourself accountable. But the other reality is, and the message that we try to champion, and again, there's many more of me. So I'm not the one that owns all 90,000. There's other individuals who own the different portfolios for their respective business. But it's that same sort of question to say, the reality is you may not be able to get it perfect. So you could do all this great work. You can read all the books. You can go and talk to all of your friends from diverse communities, but you're probably going to get it wrong. There might be a point where you get it wrong. And that's where you teach the grace. And that's not a failure. That's an opportunity for learning. And it's reframing and teaching people that you can reframe that mindset that you may be in a meeting and you may be getting it wrong. How do I come back? How do I acknowledge that person's experience and the impact versus intent? And how do we come back to a space of humanity when I do get it wrong? And that's how you keep it alive. That's how it doesn't just have to be media-based or society-based. It's really around creating that level of culture and enhancing that within our existing culture.
Speechless. Quite honestly, I can't wait to have our audience listen to this episode. Everything you said is what we value and try to cultivate within Build a Dream and try to spread into other organizations. Because one of the things that we found early on, I founded Build a Dream it started in 2014, but the work started in 2011 when I worked at a women's organization trying to get women off social assistance and into the workforce. Mm. And it wasn't just about, you know, getting more women into male dominated industries. It's about really addressing the perception, the stereotypes, how we define women at home and in the workforce. And it was really important for us to talk to young women to see how they viewed themselves, what inspired their career decisions, what factors played a role. And if confidence was an issue, and we know that young girls' self-esteem drops right as they enter high school, and that's the time that we're encouraging them to make a decision on their future careers, yet we're also telling them, yeah, go into these male-dominated industries, be one of like a few girls in your class, they struggle with that, right? Because they're already trying to focus on themselves and trying to fit in an environment that is actually not conducive to that inclusion piece. So really looking at all the layers that impacted young women's access to these pathways. So when I hear you talk about before we went external, we went actually internal and we challenged our team to look at themselves, their thoughts, their mindsets, their that's unconscious bias, like you said, can only be addressed if we become mindful and if we do lean into that uncomfortable feeling. And we know that most people don't like change and are uncomfortable with change. And a lot of what's happening right now in the systems is requiring us to really change and look at things and systems differently. This is a huge undertaking. And I appreciate that you said you're not alone in this, but what were some of the positives that came out of this? Like, what were some testimonials you got from, you know, some of the executive team that showed you that you are moving the needle? Because truly, once it starts at the top and trickles down, that's when you're going to truly see a dramatic shift 100%. In society.
You know, I think the biggest aha moment for many of them, and even again, some of the colleague footprints that I would support, whether it be tiered or middle management, those types of pieces, is that similar to your point, in understanding the women's experience as they enter into the workforce outside of post-secondary school, you can't assume their barrier, right? And we can't go and then fix the barrier on behalf of someone when we don't even understand the problem. So that was probably the most aha moment. And kind of when we look at supporting our Indigenous colleagues, when we look at supporting our Black colleagues, our visiting colleagues, our colleagues from the LGBTQ plus community, you are not in a position, regardless of your title, to answer for what that community's needed. And that's where you have to really lean into where is the systemic break and actually hear the people. So what was so profound in this and doing these activities, and we, you know, listening tours and all these things are not net new, but what you're doing is you're giving a voice and it's created a certain level of pause. And what really the last probably 5 years have shown us is that we can't go into a, we're going to fix this. And, you know, we're going to say, Black colleagues, you need these development opportunities. That is not the right approach, because you're then making an assumption for a community and you're disempowering a community to say, hey, you're not equipped because you need these additional development opportunities. So what we really try to focus on is give a voice to the community and have them address their need. And then by pulling that community, you now need to act. You can't keep tapping the well and asking for opinions and asking for thoughts and how did it make you feel and re-triggering that community and then not acting. So that's really where I was saying earlier that reciprocity model is, that if you're going to address something for women and you're going to talk about how do I remove the barriers and transition into the workforce and how do I recruit more educated talent into a big corporation like TD, you can't just assume, oh, it's because they need this, they need interview skills, they need to speak with confidence. No. What is the actual barrier? Lean into that, have a conversation, but then know that you're going to be accountable to the action. So that I would say was probably one of the biggest aha moments, was like the power of the voice and amplifying and actually saying, oh, we assumed the need was this. And we were so out of touch. And that's that vulnerability to say we're out of touch. We need to stop solving in the way that we need to solve. And what does the community actually need to propel themselves? What do they need? And how do we actually stand back and listen? And I mean, to be on a call, like I'll share this with you. I was on a call last week. There was a person on the call who just, they weren't there yet. And that's okay. They were at a different spot in their experience. And they said something that was profound. And it wasn't like heavily racist, but it was, you know, borderline, like there might've been some additional thought that should have been had there, whether it be teetering on a microaggression, but there was some thought. They just didn't understand the experience. And there was two Black colleagues on that call, myself and one other. And to sit back intentionally and watch the allies step in. So my allies on the call. So I didn't have to speak and address that individual, which traditionally I'm normally in a position where I have to. Traditionally, when you're from a racialized community, you're always on the battlefield. You always have your protective gate up. To see a testimonial like that, where I knew that I could sit back, process and think, but allow my ally to sweep in and address and coach that individual in that moment of vulnerability in a way that resonated with that individual, took the plate, the work off my plate. And that told me in itself, the system is working. The work is being done and people are getting it. And change is not a tomorrow thing, especially in the DEI space, because it is so, so, so individual. We cannot say, here's a bunch of resources. Everyone go and read it and take this workshop. And tomorrow you're going to be a heightened individual. That's not how it works, right? But to be able to show and start to see peers challenge each other and say, again, not looking for the racialized colleague or the, you know, the colleague in that group that's marginalized to step in and advocate. It's everybody else and leveraging and recognizing their privilege and what their role is and standing tall. That's when you're like, you know what? That faith in humanity is restored. That experience where people are actually wanting to say, no, I'm going to actively be anti. I'm going to stand tall and use my voice on whatever spectrum that is and not necessarily being an executive to do so. These were just two peers, again, in the trenches doing the work. But that to me was, again, like, those are the testimonials that are like, every day this work is important. These are the really real big affirmations to say that it's resonating, but within different layers of the managerial scale within our organization. So those are probably the ahas for me.
I really appreciate that example that you gave, because often what we hear is, if you're going to truly be an ally, don't be an ally behind closed doors. I want you to stand up for truth and what's actually right, like in that moment, in front of everyone, and hopefully play a role in helping to shift that mindset. And when you said this change is going to take time, I mean, we're changing cultural expectations. It's a cultural mind shift, and that will not happen overnight or in the next couple of years. It's going to take continuous and intentional
work. Yeah.
Constant. Even as an individual in this space, I'm like constantly challenging my thoughts and checking in with myself to say, do I have any unconscious biases that are coming out in how I do work? 100%. And as a leader, am I confident enough to say, you know what, I made a mistake? Or when being challenged, tell me more why you feel and why you see that we didn't actually practice DEI the way you would have interpreted, and tell us what we could do better, and or not tell us what we could do better, but help us in seeing your perspective. And let me get your thought on this. We're in this space and we got challenged quite a bit, which I think is fair. I think that challenge is good and getting different perspectives. Sometimes my frustration where it comes from is the cancel, like, let's cancel, let's shame, as opposed to let's collectively work together, because I am really intentional about this, and I'm human though. So I'm going to make mistakes. I'm going to say the wrong things. Yes, it's not your job to constantly correct me. I totally understand. But the only way forward is together, right? And when we cancel people out or when we shame them, actually we block their emotional and psychological mindset from even wanting to see the change that needs to happen. And I'm wondering where you're at in that thought process.
Yeah. Cancel culture is huge right now. And I mean, we joke about this within our friend circle personally, like if, you know, social media was as prevalent when we were growing up, like, I don't know what I would do, because everything is under such heightened sense of scrutiny. And I think, again, it infringes on the grace of humanity, and that no one is perfect. The narrative of social media and all these spaces is that you have to optically be perfect. And I think what's so beautiful about it is that, like, there's a two-sided approach. If you're performative and you're like, oh, made a mistake again, you know what I mean? Like, and you're not sitting in the truth of that and the true reconciliation of how you're going to right-size that within the community, that's one thing. And that would be tiring. And I think there's very, very little patience. And that's where you start to see people saying, like, I've had enough. But there's also another side of it where if you're living in a space of authenticity and you're saying, you know what, like, I hear you. And I'm going to hear what you're saying. And it's not when you're apologizing and saying, I'm sorry you felt that way. I've heard, you know, I hear people say that and it just like stings, because I'm like, no, you have to take an accountability for how you made someone feel. So you displacing and saying, I'm sorry you felt that way versus one or another, it doesn't live in that sense of truth of like, I had a piece of this. So I'd say that's where you start to see those who get canceled versus those who aren't. There's a level in their response that where it appeals to humanity to say, I'm genuinely wanting to understand where I went wrong here. And usually for the most part, society will envelop that and welcome that in and say, if you're really in a space authentically to learn, here's where we're going to lean in and help support and teach you. But you have to be authentic in that, because there's only so many times you can tap that same well and not show a genuine care and concern that you're actually going to heed the feedback. Because again, it's no one's spot. It's no one's spot. It's not our indigenous people's position to educate Canada. Like, just because, again, with Black Lives Matter and resurgence, what happened to the murder of George Floyd, this has been happening to this community for years. So it's wonderful that society is waking up, but we can't take away from the fact that the community partners and the people who've been doing the work have been in these trenches for years. So they'll pause and educate, and they're so honored to be able to do so and have that platform and that voice. But then it's up to everyone around, ally or not, to really heed, again, if you are impeding the line or you make a mistake in those communities or when you're communicating or you just don't understand, do your due diligence first. Don't expect for everyone to correct for you, but you have to show up authentic. Because I think if anything, over the last 3 years, society itself has said, you know, I'm no longer willing to do the talking head answers. I don't want the fake, you know, someone, your media person scripted your Twitter apology. people see through that and they're like, no, if you're asking us all to live in this space of authentic, true humanity, true sense of culture, then you need to meet us there. And that's where, again, you start to see society respond or react severely against those who just don't get it still. Because there is a sense of a veil of vulnerability that's been kind of blanketed, but you have to lean into it and you can't just show up halfway. You really got to lean in and it has to be authentic. So that's kind of my position. I mean, I'm sure it'd be terrible to be in a position of being canceled. I can imagine, you know, all the email streams and things like that would be coming up. But it's like, if you show that vulnerability, I think, honestly, society will be there to support, and the people that will be there to support. But again, you need to be honest about how much you're tapping that well and the individual work that you're doing to get there, right?
Certainly. And the way that you described it is authentic in itself. And for us at our organization, I mean, luckily, some of the feedback was not so much about cancel, but just, you know, have you thought of this? And when you did it this way, I was offended. And we had to kind of, as an organization, take an approach in terms of what is our role in the work that we do in trying to create social impact in this space, and what can we authentically take on and what can't we, and accept that as well. Like, so being in a space, I mean, you're in a corporation, we're in a not-for-profit organization. There's all these other push and pull factors that also play a role in the work that we're trying to achieve. So, but I love that you said in terms of being vulnerable and accepting that you played a role in how someone felt, and accepting that and recognizing that you have work to do to make improvements in the way you approach future conversations or situations. And it's hard because as humans, the first thing when someone
defensive.
Ego, you it's do, our ego. No yes. Yeah.
It's ego. And leave your ego. Like, everyone needs to leave their ego at home, honestly, because it's taken work, and I catch myself, and it's that daily work that we were talking about, is that you have to catch yourself when that ego slips back in. Because one, if someone is stepping out of their way to circle back with you and give you a piece of feedback that you either offended them or you could offend the broader community or whatever, the first thing that you have to do, and this has been something in mindful in my practice, is I'm like, thank you. Thank you. For one, having the courage to say this to me, because that sometimes we have to recognize is very, very difficult, especially for our diverse or marginalized communities, like to come forward in a space where they've been, traditionally positioned as, oh, I'm whistleblowing or I'm causing a ripple or a wave. Like, they're already combating that to just even show up and try and educate or teach you. So it's like, recognize that and be so thankful. And then from there, just sit and listen. No one's attacking you. And a lot of the times, I had feedback last week from a partner that said, hey, you know, when you said this, I heard this. And I was like, thank you, because that wasn't my intent. But if you came to me and you're saying that, and they genuinely came to me one-on-one, that showed me that they genuinely wished me well. And they genuinely wanted to see me succeed and articulate and use my voice for the right manner and make sure I capture, you know, whatever that nuance was. This wasn't DI related, but again, it's like all of these opportunities, it's not an individual failure because someone's saying to you, hey, when you wore this or when you said this or when you, your tone or your body language, we can't look at it offensively. We need to be like, oh my God, they might've saved me from something so much bigger. This is my chance to learn and not talk. And that's hard because half the time when someone else is talking, you can see someone else thinking about what they're going to say while you're done, like the moment you take your breath, right? So it's like, no, you need to actively sit, position it in a point of gratitude and just hear it. Some of it may be relevant to, you know, how you displace it in your mind and how you make that resonate. Some of it, you know, you may let go. Some of it may hurt you and you'll need to process that. And that's okay, right? But it's like knowing that growth within that experience and then taking it in, like, and not shying away. Like, that's half the thing with cancel culture, is it's canceled and then we hide it, right? Come into a culture where if you make a mistake, use it as a learning opportunity. Say, hey, God, like, go to your team meetings, like, depending on the scale of your business or, you know, the impact that you have within your social circle. Say, hey, I messed up here today. I want to share this with all of you guys because there's an empowerment in doing so. And here's what I learned. And here's, you know, the coaching person that came in and gave me this feedback. here's what was so important to them. Let's stop hiding when we make mistakes, because it's not punitive. It's growth and it's beautiful. But how do I leverage this and re-empower the narrative and stop treating it like it's this negative, shameful thing that we all need to hide behind? The reality is everyone's growing. And the people who are able to reframe that and do it quickly, these are the ones that you're really seeing leading in this type of space and impacting and empowering their teams, because they're not hiding it. It's not an individual attack. It's this sharing of, here's something beautiful that I was just able to experience and be thankful for that.
And even on the flip side of that, if you are the person that wants to deliver this message and give this feedback, delivery and approach also matters, because you're more like likely to get that shift in mindset or that light bulb go off in the, because I would assume that if you're giving this feedback, it's because you genuinely want the person to see the impact that they're having, mm-hmm. and you genuinely want to move the needle forward in creating more change. So I feel like, you know, everything in this, in our life is all about communication and delivery and really, you know, being mindful and intentional about what we're doing. And I think it goes both ways. And even just our work, like you're in the DEI space, I'm in the DEI space. You know, I remember, I have to give you this example real quick. We work a lot really closely with certain media organizations, because part of our goals as an organization is to create social awareness and change the perspective of women in the workforce. And I remember calling, there was an article in the paper, and I called the editor to say, as a minority woman of color, and this, you know, they were speaking to my community, I was really upset about the lens that your reporter had approached this really sensitive story. And I mean, I know I'm missing a lot of context, but I remember him responding and saying, you know, we've been having these conversations for a year. And as an organization, we've taken very intentional and meaningful steps to hear you and our community and the changes that we need to make internally so that we also play a role in the DEI work that needs to happen. So I hear you, mm-hmm. but have you ever considered calling me when we did something right? Like when you noticed that change? And I thought to myself, actually, and then I said to him, I said, quite honestly, no, because let me tell you, I'm like, but this is an excuse. And thank you for sharing this, because maybe we do need to go and say, like, as we see people doing, making changes, applauding that and saying, okay, this is great. Like, thank you for hearing me, because it also gives them that confidence. And I just thought to myself, for my ego, when at first it was like, are you kidding? Like, I'm a mother of two. Like, I run an organization. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Not only am I advocating for change, now you want me to go back
on me.
I know. Now you're putting it back on me. Now you want me to thank everybody that's committing to change. And I'm just like, oh my God, that's a lot of responsibility. It's enough to go address the changes that need to happen, let alone go back and thank them. So at first I was like, you know what? I hear you. So there's certain things I didn't agree with him on that he said, like putting the onus back on me. But then there's other things that I was like, you know what? There are ways as an organization, as a leader in the community, I could show and highlight as a best practice approach what companies are doing right, because that's good news, right? People want to feel, they want the feel good, and the feel good goes, whatever their intention is, creates a ripple effect. But if I just let my ego talk that day, it would have gone completely different. And I could have, you know, how dare you put this back on me? And, but I chose that I'm not going to win. Like, in winning in the sense of like, it's not about who's right or wrong. It's about what is my intention in this
what
work?
What is the big picture? Exactly. What's the big long game?
Yes.
What's the big picture? Yeah, 100%. And I think that's, you know, there's so many ways, like again, with social media and evolution of how society communicates now, there's so many ways that you can amplify and applaud. But again, it requires you being intentional. It requires taking those 2 seconds to like either share. Like I remember when like Barbie just recently came out with like a melanated line of like Black women in different leader positions. And I was like, I'm all over it. Like, I have all boys, but I will brush Barbie hair all day, but let me amplify that you're doing this. You know what I mean? Or Crayola came out with a melanated color line. And I was like, finally, I shall color my skin pigment in like the right
color. Or the emojis, when like the emojis came out with this different like,
I was like, finally, there's a thumb that matches my hand so I can thumb up appropriately. So these are all big wins. And it's like, there's ways to amplify it. I hear both sides. And I think that's the neat piece is like, like society has shifted and the conversation and people are wanting to have it, how we do so and how we get to a place of like understanding is really just that daily intentional practice and checking our ego. And our ego has so much to go into it. And the reality is like we've all grown up with these systems that tell us I should think this way, whether it be from a women's empowerment and how we view our bodies and how we're told to question our bodies and our self-worth or question our intent when applying for a job. Like as a baby being born into this world, you weren't born with any of those self-preconceived thoughts, fears, worries. So I try to like live as freely as possible. And anytime you get there, you need to have a mechanism to check yourself because you are the output. You bring that energy. And anytime, like, you know, and it really is an individual journey. So like, you know, people like me, people like you who are doing the work in the DI space, we can challenge and continue to try and push for these conversations. But there's got to be a point where individually you buy in, like listeners buy in, leaders buy in, and they go, you know what? There's probably something I can do here. I may not be the head of the march empowering the rally, but there's something I can do inside my home. And no one's asking me to be Martin Luther King. No one's asking me to do this. But what they are asking me to do is just care, look at myself, look how I'm communicating, think about my language, how I'm interacting with others. Like that's all anyone's asking. And I think it's demystifying it. And that's really kind of like, if I was doing a roadshow for 2022, that would be my message is one, you're going to fail. Two, when you fail, it's the grace in how you come back, right? Like when you think about really, really strong leaders, it's the grace of when they come back and they own that mistake and the accountability and not being afraid of accountability. Because accountability is a scary thing. I got a teenager and he hates it. But it's teaching that and having that conversation and then checking that ego and our responses. And I'm telling you, it's like, it's so freeing when you can live in a space and say, you know what? These are society's norms. I'm going to live authentic to myself as possible. And that kind of brings it back to your first question, which is like, why did you jump into this space? I was like, if I want to look back at my legacy, and I want to look at the impact that I can make in this world. Where are the spaces that I can do that? And if there's a parallel and I can be afforded this opportunity within a finance career to touch lives, then I'm going to try to do that because it aligns with my moral compass and I can be authentically me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and still do, you know, the things that drive business strategy or acumen and check that box, but I can do so with purpose. And I challenge everyone to look at that in their own job, whether it's DEI or unrelated and you're a chef in, you know, the restaurant industry, there's something that you can do to align to your compass. And when you live in that space, you vibrate at that frequency and these opportunities and these like-minded individuals, they will come out of the woodwork and find you and have these thoughtful conversations. Like, you know, even meeting you today, like, what are the odds? Like, again, but like-minded energies connect. And then you're just like, all right, let's have these thoughtful conversations and amplify the change that we can do together. Right. But it's sitting and checking yourself first, looking yourself in the mirror every morning.
100%. And it's so funny that you just mentioned that because when you said, if I were to go on a roadshow in 2022, I'm thinking, can you please go on a roadshow in 2022? And I'm going to be that like fan that like follows you around and listens to you.
Oh my God, this would be my life goals. I'm like, if I can just literally talk to people all day and be basically like Oprah's shadow, like I'd be in heaven.
I think you could be your own Oprah.
Hey, speak that into existence. We're speaking it into existence.
I'm going to speak it into existence.
Yeah, let's manifest that.
Because you do host a show though. You do host a show, a talk show?
Yeah, well, we did it. Yeah, we did it. It was really in the height of resurgence, Black Lives Matter. Again, it was with myself and five other amazing, amazing, amazing Black individuals. And we really were like, listen, the media is saying this. Black people are saying X. And there was a huge disparity between this is a US-based experience versus a real Canadian conversation. And we like literally like, again, the five of us had known each other forever. There's such a spectrum in our experiences. There was different age. There was different, you know, thoughts, opinions. We had an amazing, amazing lineup of individuals. And we just were like, you know what? There's work that has to be done and I can't stay silent. And I can't have this picture of us just our people looting buildings and that being one narrative when there's a whole other spectrum and intersectionality in the Black Canadian experience and that our experience is not so different than, say, a European experience or an Indigenous. There's parodies. There's very big differences, but there's also unifiers. Now let's talk about those unifiers and let's talk about the taboos that aren't being put on the media and the why behind our behaviors. You know, something as simple as, I remember, like, again, as allies were trying to figure out, how do I quickly, you know, understand the Black experience? What's the big deal about the hair? Why can't I touch their hair? Like, so taking on taboo topics like that to say, it's not that we don't, you know, I mean, I think it's weird when anybody touches anybody's hair because, like,
right,
frizz is a real problem.
Like, I hear
too
you.
Much touching causes frizz. But I think it was like, no, let, there's a teaching moment here. And it's the objectivity and it's being treated as, like, you know, a showpiece and causing undue attention that I've not wanted. Like, it's the teaching through those experiences. So that was kind of where we pitched it to Rogers and we did a series on it. So no, it was a really, really neat experience, but it's so empowering to see so many pop-up conversations that come out of that. And other amazing, amazing, amazing melanated voices from across different communities, marginalized communities that are saying, no, we need to actually tell our story. And it's not this media story. Like, if you want to talk to the people or content creators, the people doing the work, this isn't net new to us. We've been in these spaces. And if you want to know what's happening or where to donate or, you know, how to actually support and talk with people, here's, you know, 17 spaces to do so. So that was a really, really cool experience.
I actually want you to come talk to my team about it, like host a session, a lunch and learn, because it's so amazing. And like,
let me tell you about hair.
Well, yes. It's funny because we do often have conversations about hair, but it's a whole different scenario at our organization. But where can someone find these episodes? Because I think it's still really relevant. And even me as a leader, I would love to hear those conversations because that is the essence of Perfectly Unfiltered. It's not just so much about, let's increase the participation of women from 5% to 15% in the skill trades. Okay, great. We moved the needle in that part. But what is their experience? If it's still the same and they still feel that they have to work twice as hard and that it's not an inclusive 100%. Environment, it doesn't matter that we moved at 10%, right? So, I mean, it does, yeah. But like not, I don't want to hide in the fact that we succeeded when there's truth left on the table that we need to talk about. That's uncomfortable.
Well, that's the, like, honestly, that point right there to me resonates so much because we do such a great job of creating a goal, hitting said goal, and then slapping ourselves on the back and be like, oh my God, we did so good. And it's like, cool. But if you didn't shift the culture in that business, everybody that you spent all those calories and probably copious amount of funds by working with external vendors to source that talent, they will leave in a year or two. Because
and that's proven.
Actually, it's proven. I'm not making it up. Like, there's stats. So it's like, again, if it really is, you want to do the work and you really want to change the space and you want to incubate that talent and you want to foster these growth environments, you need to think about the culture and what is the culture the day after? And then how are you setting up that talent for success? If you're going to, in your example, bring women into these skilled trade roles, are they set up for success after they get the job? Because getting the job isn't the checkbox. It's sustaining and creating and extending the ladder so the next woman can get the job and the next one after that. And that it isn't this big barrier and you're taking a risk on hiring this woman. It's actually shifting the mentality of the culture to say, no, this isn't a risk because she's a woman and you know, did a great job and drove a representation number. Actually, there's an amazing set of experiences that come with that. There's an amazing set of perspectives that can come with maybe potentially how a woman physiologically processes something versus a male counterpart or even diversity within their experiences and cultural beliefs. Like, there's so much beauty within that, but you have to reframe the culture. So there really is a day two. So there's like talent and recruitment day one, but it's like, what's the day two? And then how do you actually support that incubated talent into the business so that they can be successful and that they move from that role? Because getting them in and letting them stay stagnant and twist in the wind at that job, like, that's not a success factor. That wouldn't be a KPI or a key performance indicator that I would stand on. It's like, this is where, again, when you talk about, you know, what are we doing at TD? We don't, anything that gets deployed, we circle back on. So you can't just hide and give yourself the high five and say, yes, we drove this representation number, or we did X, Y, and Z for this community. We launched it. It's deployed. No, it's lifting the curtain up after and saying, was this project impactful? Did it drive the assumptions that you thought it was going to drive? And what else did it teach you? And how can you take and grow from that and expand it 2.0 or whatever the case may be? But if you got it wrong, let's acknowledge where you got it wrong and actually like solicit the right feedback, socialize the right feedback so that you can get it right. But you can't just launch and then walk away. And too far often, because of the speed to go to market for all of these corporations at this big scale, it's like an urgency to get the product out there, get the product, the initiative, the project out there. But it's like creating that level of pause to say impact versus intent. If your intent was X and your impact was severely lacking here, that's not a win. So how do we actually marry those two together, right? So I think your engineering example or your skilled trades example is another perfect one where I see too many times we're like, yes, we hired the women. But then it's like, no, those women either left that industry, you see the C-session, you see women having challenges through COVID. It's like, these are real barriers that we need to lean into and actually kind of lift up the curtain on and figure out how we're going to integrate this workforce back.
Ali, like I still have so many questions to ask you and our time is coming to an end because it's shown that people like to listen to an hour or less of the podcast, although I really do feel people are going to love listening to you. So we're going to have to do episode two. Like we need an episode two because I want to dig a little bit. Like we're going to have to, and I'm going to have my team schedule it because there's so much more I want to unpack in the meantime, because you're representing TD, you're doing incredible work. I can't believe our paths have crossed. I'm so excited to potentially one day after COVID meet you in person.
I know. See if you have legs. Let's see.
Yeah, I do.
I have 20 colleagues that I've never met from the torso down. So I'm always like, oh, how tall are you? Like, what do you look like in real life?
I had a COVID baby, right?
I've had like five friends that are like, and I'm leaving, or colleagues, right? I'm leaving for mat leave next week. And you're like, when were you pregnant? What did I miss? I'm a terrible person.
It was like 9 months. No. Because no one ever knows, right? I have my chief of staff is pregnant. Yeah. And she, like, you could never tell. But
no.
What I want to know, I guess the last thing I want to leave the viewers with, and I didn't even get into the questions that were prepped. So, but this is why it's called Perfectly Unfiltered. So TD Bank is investing all this money and resources and tools into driving this forward. As a consumer, as a customer of TD, where do I find this? Is there a space where you guys share your outcomes, share your progress with the world, with your community?
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. So I would encourage everyone, check out, if you go to our TD main, like TD.com page, our Ready Commitment is the language that we use. So we have an entire website as well as annual fiscal reporting that speaks to, so you can hold us accountable. We're very transparent as far as how we report, ESG, like all of these culminating things that come together as far as how we actually interconnect our communities and what pillars that we believe in and what we're fostering and supporting, some of the projects, some of the different funding allocations. Like if you're really wanting to figure out, one, how do I learn more? Two, how do I get involved with it, right? Because there's certain opportunities that you can come when you have corporate backing and big scale at events and things like that. So I would encourage you guys to check there, the TD Ready Commitment, because again, all of the annual reports, all the way again, across the diaspora of this, and that it's really ESG strategy is outlined there. And again,
ESG, you know, different just for our listeners.
Environment, social, and governance. So it's really around the different strategies where each business is speaking to how are they going to move the environment? How are they going to move social impact? What are the government policies, procedures? What is the entire bureaucratic piece of it that needs to be changed as well? The entire overview is there and all the different intricacies that fall within it. So,
love it.
And I mean, again, the education and market and systems is completely evolving. I did my master's with a specialization in that. So when you think about this, spaces to learn, oh man,
no.
Totally worth the acronym.
I love it, Ali. You know what? We're in the space where there's a lot of acronyms and I'm learning to always often ask, what does that acronym stand for? Because I'm also
100%. I make up new ones on a daily basis and
it's
easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as Build a Dream is a recipient of the corporate giving arm of TD Bank, and we've been really thankful for all the support that TD has provided us for our International Day of the Girl annual conference, to our career expos that we launch across Canada, empowering young women to see themselves in these career pathways, and just the hands-on investment that they have in some of our workshops that's not now taking it a step further to not only attract, but really recruit young women into this space. And the retention piece that TD meets is by connecting us with exceptional leaders like yourself that share their diversity and thought, that share the best practices, so that other partners of ours and other listeners can really adopt some of this so that they can influence change within their own environment. Because we can't be everywhere, but we could spread the message so that people have the Absolutely. Tools and the resources, as well as the connection to a network to drive this change forward. So Ali, I'm not kidding. We're having another episode in a couple of months because I have so many more questions.
And I'm 100%, so grateful. I love meeting everyone in this space. So 100% count me in. Always, always happy to have these types of conversations because again, like we're not going to get there unless we all get there together. So we have to sit in this and have these kind of conversations. And if you have a platform where you can amplify it, sign me up. Happy to showcase and speak to what's really happening in the world.
Well, thank you for your voice and your authenticity. And it was so great chatting with you today.
My pleasure.